Not only does the glory radiate from him in white light, but all colors of the rainbow play round him, in ever-changing gleams like mother of pearl. Hence there is something in that radiation to strengthen the highest qualities in every person who approaches him, no matter what qualities may be. None can come within the range of his influence without being the better for it. He shines upon all around him like the sun, for like that luminary, he has become a manifestation of the Logos. Page 72. The causal body of the adept or master has enormously increased in size and shines with a sun-like splendor far beyond all imagination in its glorious loveliness. Of the beauty and form and color here, as C.W. Leadbeater states, no words can speak, for mortal language has no terms in which those radiant spheres may be described. Such a vehicle would be a separate study itself, but one quite beyond the powers of any but those who are already far on the path. As in the case of the causal body of an Arhat, the colors no longer move in whirling clouds, but are arranged in great concentric shells, yet penetrated everywhere by radiations of living light, always pouring forth from him as a center. The order of the colors varies according to the type to which the adept belongs, so that there are several well-marked varieties amid their glory. A perfectly accurate tradition of this fact has been preserved in many of the roughly drawn pictures of the Lord Buddha, which may be seen upon temple walls in Ceylon. The great teacher is usually represented thus surrounded by an aura, and, although the coloring and general arrangement of those surroundings would be very inaccurate, and even impossible, if intended for the aura of an ordinary man, or even for that of one who is the rank of the master, yet it is a rough and material representation of the actual higher vehicle of the adept of that particular type, to which this great one belongs. The causal body is sometimes called the aura keg. But, when H.P. Blavatsky spoke of the sacred aura keg, it seems probable that she meant the four permanent atoms, more accurately, the physical and astral permanent atoms, the mental unit, and the mental permanent atom, comma within an envelope of matter of the atmic of nirvanic plane. The causal body is known also as the Orgeides, the glorified man. It is not an image of any one of his past vehicles, but contains within itself the essence of all that was best in each of them. It thus indicates, more or less perfectly, as through experience it grows, what the deity means that man shall be. For, as we have seen, by observation of the causal vehicle it is possible to see the stage of evolution which the man has reached. Not only can his past history be seen, but also to a considerable extent the future that lies before him. The glorified form within the causal body is an approach to the archetype and comes nearer to it as man develops. The human form appears to be the model for the highest evolution in this particular system. It is varied slightly in different planets, but is, broadly speaking, the same in general outline. In other solar systems, forms may possibly be quite unlike it. On that point we have no information. Prana, or vitality, exists in all planes, and therefore must play some part in the causal body, but concerning this no information is at present available. We may note, however, that after the formation of the causal body, the complexity of the prana circulating in the nervous system of the physical body much increases, and it appears to become yet more enriched in the progress of human evolution. For, as the consciousness becomes active on the mental plane, the, page 73, prana of that plane mingles with the lower, as the activity of consciousness is carried on in higher regions. In the causal body also, as in each of the other vehicles, there are chakrams or force centers, which in addition to other functions, serve as points of connection at which force flows from one vehicle to another. At present time, however, no information is available regarding the chakrams of the causal body. Page 74, Chapter 17, Causal Thought. The mental plane, as we know, is the sphere of action of what we call mind or manas, in man. As we have already seen, the plane is divided into two parts, the higher, consisting of three upper sub-planes, and the lower, consisting of the four lower sub-planes. The two divisions are known as arupa, or formless, and rupa, having form. In man, intellect has, as its vehicle, the causal body, with abstract thought as its function, whilst mind has, as its vehicle, the mental body, with the function of concrete thinking. The mind acquires knowledge by utilizing the senses for observations, it works on its percepts, and builds them into concepts. Its powers are attention, memory, reasoning by induction and deduction, imagination, and the like. The names arupa and rupa are given in order to indicate a certain quality of the matter of the mental plane. In the lower part of it, the matter is very readily molded by the action of human thought into definite forms. In the higher division, this does not occur, the more abstract thought of that level expressing itself to the eye of the clairvoyant in flashes or streams. On the arupa levels, the difference in the effect of thought is very marked, especially as regards the elemental essence. The disturbance set up in the mere matter of the plane is similar, though greatly intensified in this much more refined form of matter. But in the elemental essence, no form at all is now created, and the method of action is entirely changed. On the lower sub-planes, an elemental or thought form, which is the created, hovers about the person thought of, and awaits a favorable opportunity of expending its energy either upon his mental body, his astral body, or even his physical body. But on the three higher sub-planes, the result is a kind of lightning flash of the essence from the causal body of the thinker, direct to the causal body of the object of his thought. So that, while on the lower sub-planes the thought is always directed to the mere personality, on the higher sub-planes we influence the reincarnating ego, the real man himself. If the message has any reference to the personality, it will reach that personality only from above, through the instrumentality of the causal body. It is said to be a striking sight to observe the change from an abstract or arupa idea to a concrete or rupa thought, as the idea clothes itself in the matter of the four lower subplanes. The standard and sample example is that of a triangle. Difficult as it is to describe in words, which belong, page 75, to the planes of form, the abstract idea of a triangle is a reality on the arupa levels. It means a non-figure, which is yet a figure. The figure which is yet no particular figure, is circumscribed by three lines, yet not by any particular lines. Its three angles possess the property of making collectively two right angles, yet they are not particular angles. On the arupa levels, this abstract idea of a triangle has real existence. With the sense of the causal body, it is seen, or apprehended. It is a fact of consciousness, external to the observer, even though it is not what we usually mean by form. If such an abstract triangle is thrown into contact with the matter of the rupa subplanes, instantly it becomes an indefinite number of triangles, each of which has a definite form. There will be triangles of every known shape: equilateral, isosceles, scalene, right-angled, acute-angled, obtuse-angled, it'll coming into visible existence. If the abstract idea is brought down within the causal body, the observer becomes a fountain of triangles, which go off in all directions, much as a jet of water spurts up as a more or less coherent mass, comes down as a fountain, separating into innumerable drops of spray. That is perhaps the best physical analogy of the process that can be given. As was fully explained in the mental body, concrete thought naturally takes the shape of the objects which we thought about. Abstract ideas, when thrown down into the rupa levels, usually represent themselves by all kinds of perfect and the most beautiful geometrical figures. It should, however, be remembered that many thoughts which come down here are little more than mere abstractions, become on the mental plane concrete facts. Causal consciousness thus deals with the essence of a thing, whilst the lower mind studies its details. With the mind, we talk round a subject, or endeavor to explain it. With the causal consciousness, we take up the essence of the idea of the subject, and move it as a whole, as one moves a piece when playing chess. The causal plane is a world of realities. We no longer deal with emotions, ideas or conceptions, but with the thing in itself. It may be well to describe rather more in detail the process of arriving at causal thought. Whilst the lower mind dwells entirely on mental images, obtained from sensations, reasons on purely concrete objects, and is concerned with the attributes which differentiate one object from another, the ego, using the causal consciousness, having learned to discriminate clearly between objects, By dwelling upon their unlikenesses now begins to group them together by some attribute which appears in a number of objects, otherwise dissimilar, and makes a link between them. He draws out, abstracts, this common attribute, and sets all objects that possess it apart from the rest that are without it. In this way, he evolves the power of recognizing identity amid diversity, a step towards the much later recognition of the one underlying the many. Page 76, he thus classifies all that is around him, developing the synthetic faculty, and learning to construct as well as to analyze. Presently, he takes another step, and conceives of the common property as an idea, apart from all the objects in which it appears, and thus constructs a kind of mental higher image higher than the image of a concrete object, the image of an idea that has no phenomenal existence in the world of form, but which exists on the higher levels of the mental plane, and affords material on which the ego, the thinker himself, can work. The lower mind reaches the abstract idea by reason, and, in so doing, accomplishes its loftiest flight, touching the threshold of the formless world, and dimly seeing that which lies beyond. The thinker with his causal consciousness, sees these ideas, and lives among them habitually. As he exercises and develops the power of abstract reasoning, he becomes so effective in his own world, and begins his life of active functioning in his own sphere. Such a man would care little for the life of the senses, or for external observation, or for mental application to images of external objects. His powers are indrawn, no longer rushing outwards in the search for satisfaction. He dwells calmly within himself, engrossed with the problems of philosophy, with the deeper aspects of life and thought, seeking to understand causes, rather than troubling himself with effects, and approaching nearer and nearer to the recognition of the one that underlies all the diversities of external nature. The method of passing from the lower mental to the causal consciousness, by means of an orderly process of concentration, meditation, and contemplation, is described in detail in the mental body, and so need not be repeated here. On the higher levels of the mental plane, thoughts act with much greater force than on the lower levels. One reason for this is that, as comparatively few are as yet able to think on these higher levels, any thoughts which are generated there have the field practically to themselves, that is, there are not many other thoughts in that realm with which they have to contend. Most thoughts of the ordinary man begin in the mental body, on the lower mental levels, and clothe themselves, as they descend, with the appropriate astral elemental essence. But, when a man is active on the causal levels, his thought commences there, and clothes itself first in the elemental ascension of the lower levels of the mental plane, and is consequently infinitely finer, more penetrating, and in every way more effective. If the thought be directed exclusively to higher objects, its vibrations may be of too fine a character to find, page 77, expression on the astral plane at all. But if they do affect such lower matter, they will do so with much more far-reaching effect than those which are generated so much nearer to the level of that lower matter. Following this principle a stage further, it is clear that the thought of the initiate, taking its rise upon the buddhic plane, above the mental world altogether, will clothe itself with the elemental essence of the causal subplanes. Similarly, the thought of the adept will pour down from the plane of Atma, wielding the tremendous and wholly incalculable powers of regions beyond the ken of the ordinary humanity. Hence the truth of the saying that the work of one day, on levels such as these, may well surpass in efficiency the toil of 1,000 years on the physical plane. Students who are not accustomed to causal thought, to thinking in principles, should be careful that they do not, by their efforts to think abstractly, at first cause headaches, which mean, of course, in this instance, that the mechanism of the brain is being strained. Meditation, practiced regularly for a number of years, should establish a certain tendency of the causal consciousness to be affected by the consciousness in the mental body. When that has been established, abstract thought at the causal levels should be possible without the risk of straining the thinking mechanism. When the effort to form an abstract conception, say of a triangle, has been successful, the student may at first feel a little dazed in the attempt to grasp the abstract idea, Later the consciousness will suddenly change and become clear. That means that the center of consciousness has been transferred from the mental to the causal body, and the student becomes conscious, in his causal body, of a distinct existence outside himself. That is the intuition of the causal body, which recognizes the outer. The intuition of buddhi, as we shall see in a later chapter, recognizes the inner, enabling one to see things from the inside. With the intellectual intuition, one realizes a thing which is outside oneself. Again, the student may be reminded that, in spite of external differences of functioning between the higher and lower mind, yet manas, the thinker, is one, the self in the causal body. It is the source of innumerable energies of vibrations of innumerable kinds. These it sends out, raying outwards from itself. The subtlest and finest of these are expressed in the matter of the causal body, which alone is fine enough to respond to them. They form what is sometimes called the pure reason, whose thoughts are abstract, whose method of gaining knowledge is intuition. Its very nature is knowledge, and it recognizes truth at sight as congruous with itself. The less subtle vibrations pass outward from the one thinker, attracting the matter of the lower mental world, and becoming the activities of the lower mind, as has already been described. It is, perhaps, somewhat unfortunate that buddhi is also sometimes spoken of as pure reason, and its faculty is described as that of intuition. As psychology progresses, no doubt appropriate terms will be selected, and applied, specifically and solely, to the distinct functions of the causal consciousness, and to, page 78, the buddhic faculties. It was said above, of manas, that its very nature is knowledge. That is so, because manas is the reflection, in the atomic matter of the mental plane, of the cognitional aspect of the self as knower. It is therefore possible to unfold the power of knowing truth at sight. This shows itself only when the lower mind, with its slow process of reasoning, is transcended. For whenever the I, the expression of the self whose nature is knowledge, comes into contact with the truth, he finds its vibrations regular and therefore capable of producing a coherent image in himself, whereas the false causes a distorted image, out of proportion, by its very reflection announcing its nature. As the lower mind assumes a more and more subordinate position, these powers of the ego assert their own predominance, and intuition, which is analogous to the direct vision of the physical plane, takes the place of reasoning, which may aptly be compared with the physical plane sense of touch. Thus intuition develops out of reasoning in the same unbroken manner, and without change of essential nature, as the eye develops out of touch. The change of manner should not blind us to the orderly and sequential evolution of the faculty. The student will, of course, be careful to distinguish genuine intuition from that pseudo-intuition of the unintelligent, which is merely impulse, born of desire, and is not higher, but lower than reasoning. The act of thinking develops the spirally in the physical atoms, hence those who are definitely and carefully thinking day by day are not only improving their own powers of thought, but also improving for others the amount of available material of a higher kind, thus facilitating high thinking. In the etheric body of man, the brow chakram, or force center, which utilizes the dark blue prana, is associated with the principle of higher manas. Page 79, Chapter 18, Development and Faculties of the Causal Body. In Chapter 15, we saw that only good elements are stored in the causal body, evil finding in that body no means of expression. We may now consider this matter a little further, and study the effects which are produced, more or less indirectly, on the causal body by the practice of evil. In a primitive man, the growth of the causal body is necessarily exceedingly slow. As we have seen, it is by the method of exciting sympathetic vibration that the higher qualities, developed by the life on lower planes, are gradually built into the causal body, but in the life of an undeveloped man there will be very few feelings or thoughts, belonging to the higher world, which can serve as food for the growth of the real man. Hence the growth is slow, for all the rest of life does not aid it. But even the worst of men can commonly show himself on the causal plane, though as an entirely undeveloped entity. His vices, even though continued through life after life, cannot soil the causal body. They can, however, make it more and more difficult to develop the opposite virtues. In every case, the existence of an evil quality in the personality means a lack of the corresponding good quality in the causal body. For an ego cannot be evil, though he can be imperfect. The qualities which the ego develops cannot be other than good qualities, and, when they are well defined, they show themselves in each of all his numerous personalities. Consequently, those personalities can never be guilty of the vices opposite to those good qualities. A good quality which is lacking may nevertheless be said to exist in the ego, although it has not yet been called into activity. As soon as it is called into activity, its intense vibrations will act upon the lower vehicles, and it will be impossible, as said, for the opposite evil ever again to find place in them. Where there is a gap in the ego, indicating that there is a quality undeveloped, there need not necessarily be a definite vice in the personality, but there is also nothing positive in the personality to prevent the growth of the vice in question. Hence, since in all probability many other people around him already possess that vice, and since man is an imitative animal, it is more than likely that they will develop that vice. The vice, however, as we have seen, belongs only to the lower vehicles, and not to the real man in the causal body. In those lower vehicles its repetition may set up a momentum which it is hard to conquer. But, if the ego bestirs himself to create in himself the opposite virtue, the vice is cut off at the root, and can no longer exist, neither in this life nor in all the lives that are to come. Thus the shortest way to get rid of evil, and prevent its reappearance, is to fill the gap in the ego, so that the good quality which is thus developed will show itself as an integral part of the man's character through all his future lives. Whilst evil cannot be definitely stored in the causal body, yet the practice of evil may affect the causal, page 80, body. For every intensification of vice in the lower vehicles, every indulgence in it in the lower worlds, tends somewhat to dim the luminosity of the opposite virtues in the causal body. The eye cannot assimilate anything that is evil, for it cannot touch the eye level of consciousness. The ego is not conscious of evil, he knows nothing about it, so that it makes no impression upon him. The utmost result brought about, in the causal body by very, very long continued lives of a low type, is what may be called incapacity to receive the opposite good impression for a very considerable period afterwards, a kind of numbness or paralysis of the matter of the causal body. This is not so much consciousness as unconsciousness, an unconsciousness which resists impressions of the good of the opposite kind. That is the limit of the harm that is done. Hence, when the life of evil has been very much prolonged, it will take many more lives in order to bring out the first response to the good side of activity. This result was observed when, in studying past lives, an endeavor was made to understand how the causal body was not injured through a number of savage lives. In very prolonged cases, where there was an abnormal number of such lives, this effect of numbness was noted, brought about by the repeated beating upon it of evil, over a long period of time. A number of lives then had to be spent in restoring, so to say, the responsive vitality to that portion of the causal body. Such cases, however, are abnormal. We may pursue the study of the effects of evil still further. Where evil is subtle and persistent, it drags away, if the expression be permitted, something of the individual himself. If evil be continually followed, the mental body becomes so entangled with the astral body, that after death it cannot free itself entirely, some of its very substance is torn away from it, and, when the astral body in its turn dies and disintegrates, the matter of the mental body, which has been wrenched away, also goes back to the general stock of mental matter, and is thus lost to the individual. In ordinary cases, the harm done to the causal body does not go further than this. We shall deal with this aspect of our subject in more technical detail in chapter 25, where, however, the ego has become strong, both in intellect and in will. Without at the same time increasing in unselfishness and love, it contracts itself round its own separated center, instead of expanding. As it grows, it thus builds around it a wall of selfishness, and uses its developing powers for itself, instead of for others. In such cases, there arises the possibility, alluded to in so many of the world scriptures, of the ego setting himself consciously against the good law, of fighting deliberately against evolution. Then the casual body itself shows the dark hues, brought about by contraction, and loses the dazzling radiance which is its characteristic property. Harm such as this cannot be wrought by an ego who is poorly developed, nor by ordinary passional or mental faults. To effect injury so far-reaching, the ego must be highly evolved, and must have its energies awakened on the mental plane. It is for this reason that ambition, pride and powers of the intellect, used for selfish aims, are so far more dangerous, and deadly in their effects, than the more palpable faults of the lower nature. So that the Pharisee is often further from the kingdom of God than the publican and sinner. Along this line is developed the black magician. The man who conquers passion and desire, develops will and the higher powers of the mind, not to offer them as forces to help forward the evolution of the whole, but in order to grasp all he can for himself as a unit, to hold, and not to share. Such men set themselves to maintain separation as against unity, striving to retard instead of to quicken evolution. They vibrate in discord with the whole, instead of harmony, and are in danger of that rending of the ego himself, which means the, page 81, loss of all the fruits of evolution. Hitherto we have spoken mainly of the effects of evil on a man's growth. Let us now look at the other side of the picture. All those who are beginning to understand something of the causal body, can make its evolution a definite object in life. They can strive to think, feel and act unselfishly, and so contribute to its growth and activity. Life after life this evolution of the individual proceeds, and, in aiding its growth by conscious effort, we are working in harmony with the divine will, and carrying out the purpose for which we are here. Nothing good, that is once woven into the causal body, can ever be lost or dissipated, for this is the man that lives, so long as he remains man. Thus we see that by the law of evolution everything that is evil, however strong it may seem, has within itself the germ of its own destruction, while everything that is good has in it the seed of immortality. The secret of this lies in the fact that everything evil, is inharmonious, because it sets itself against the cosmic law. Sooner or later, therefore, it is broken up by that law, dashed into pieces against it. Everything that is good, on the other hand, being in harmony with the law, is taken on by it and carried forward. It becomes part of the stream of evolution, of that not ourselves, which makes for righteousness, and therefore can never perish or be destroyed. We may conceive of all the experience of a man as passing through a fine sieve or mesh, only that which is good can pass through, that which is evil is left behind, rejected. In this, the very mechanism by which the causal body, the vehicle of the man that endures, is built up, lies not only the hope of man, but the certainty of his final triumph. However slow the growth, it is there. However long the way, it has its ending. The individual, which is ourself, is evolving, and cannot be utterly destroyed. Even though by our folly we may make the growth slower than it need be, nonetheless everything we contribute to it, however little, lasts in it forever, and is our possession for all the ages that lie in front. Whilst nothing evil can be stored in the causal body, it is, however, stored, if we may so use a term, in the lower vehicles to which it pertains. For under the law of justice, every man must receive the results of his own actions, be they bad or good. But evil necessarily works itself out on the lower planes, because it is only the matter of those planes that its vibrations can be expressed, and it has not even overtones capable of awakening a response in the causal body. Its force, therefore, is all expended at its own level, and it reacts in its entirety upon its creator in his astral and physical life, whether in this or in future incarnations. More precisely, the result of evil is stored in the mental unit and in the astral and physical permanent atoms, and so the man has to face it over and over again. But that, of course, is a very different matter from taking it into the ego and making it really a part of himself. Good actions and thoughts also, of course, produce results on the lower planes, but, in addition to that, they have the immensely higher and permanent effect upon the causal body. Thus all alike produce effects on the lower planes, and are manifested in the lower temporary vehicles, but good qualities alone are retained in the causal body as so much definite gain to the real man.